So this is a quote that I begin with. Right talk is inherently aggressive, even imperial. It tends towards moral inflation and militates against accommodation. Rights talkers, with their inner monologues of preemptive resentments, work themselves into a simmering state of annoyed vigilance against any limits on their willfulness, unquote. That harsh judgment was made by George Will in a column in the Washington Post in 2009. And in that column in which Will was criticizing Wright's talk, he mentioned one of the most celebrated academic criticisms of Wright's talk, which was a book published in 1991 called Wright's Talk, by the Harvard law professor and later U.S. ambassador to the Vatican, Marianne Glendon. And this Glendon, like George Will, is kind of a conservative, and this conservative criticism of Wright's talk usually focuses on what's seen as a kind of individualistic, agonistic, kind of zero-sum politics that flows out of a concentration on rights, which is really no politics at all. It's more like what's left of politics in a community that's become rigidly legalistic and incapable of honest communal deliberation. So there's the suggestion that rights are a kind of modern idea connected, perhaps causally, with some of the characteristic problems of modern politics. Mainly individualism, a kind of individualism that dilutes the bonds of community and leads to a kind of lonely egoism that's identified by many social thinkers, but also a politics characterized by constant rancor and an unwillingness to compromise. That may or may not be an accurate description. It is, however, accurate in the proposition that the cause of rights talk, or the subject of rights talk, namely rights, is it an accurate description of that? And my answer is, it depends. Specifically, it depends on just how one understands rights, on how one talks about rights. My talk about rights is divided into four parts. First, I want to pose two more specific problems that quickly emerge when we apply ourselves to the question of rights in light of the problems that were noted by George Will and Marianne Glendon. Secondly, I want to make some distinctions about rights that concern the two fundamental questions about them, which is what are rights and what explains their existence. And third, I want to look at what seems to me the key text of Aquinas on this question, after which, fourth, I'll suggest the lines of a kind of Thomistic understanding of our practice of rights that I think goes a good bit towards mitigating some of the problems discussed by people like George Will and Marianne Glendon. So I want to begin then in the first section with two more quotations. Now the first one, pretty recognizable, I think. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. These are obviously the words of the Declaration of Independence, which established the United States as a nation dedicated first and foremost to the protection of fundamental rights, the fundamental rights of its people. Indeed, we can call these rights natural rights, since the Declaration refers to them not only as self-evident truths, but in the immediately preceding sentence, it refers to the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. The fundamental basis of American government, then, seems to be natural rights. Now consider a second quotation. This one is from a document produced some 216 years later. Quote, at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. Beliefs about these matters could not define the attributes of personhood were they formed under compulsion of the state. Read that again. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, meaning of the universe and of the mystery of human life. Beliefs about these matters could not define the attributes of personhood, but they're formed by the compulsion of the state. Anybody know what that's from?
Roe v. Wade or some court case?
Close. So it's from a case, a Supreme Court decision called Planned Parenthood versus Casey from 1992. So Roe versus Wade was 1973. So, but Planned Parenthood versus Casey reaffirmed the court's holding in Roe versus Wade. So it reaffirmed the existence of a constitutional right to abortion. Now, like the Declaration of Independence, it's fundamentally concerned with rights, but the similarity perhaps ends there. The Declaration of Independence, as I said, grounds itself in the laws of nature and nature's God, which are self-evident truths. The Casey Court held, or so it seems on any plain reading, that there is a fundamental right, quote, to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life, unquote. It's hard to know what to make of this passage, promulgated as it was, solemnly and authoritatively by our highest court, even as a matter of logic. How, for example, does one define a mystery? If one can define one's own concept of meaning, does that not pose problems for anyone else's claims to have rights? How does one person recognize the rights of another person if one has a different concept of meaning than they do? Moreover, I have to confess that even though I make my living as a professional student of philosophy, I shudder to think of what I would do if I were required to produce my own concept of the universe. That's just what it is. I don't have a concept of it. So the question here is this: what happened? What explains the transition from the Declaration of Independence's doctrine of natural rights, recognizable as self-evident truths, to Casey's right to define one's own universe? Clearly, something has changed. Now, I said that they do have one thing in common, and that they both concern fundamental rights. Now, this common element has led some to think that the change was in some sense foreordained, that if the country was founded on the doctrine of individual rights, the transition to a kind of radical individualism, in fact, a radical individualism that leads to relativism and perhaps even to nihilism, was an easy transition. We have arrived where we are because we began where we started. And the discourse of individual rights is the culprit in this. As I say, there are some people who hold that view. Now that leads me to a second problem I want to notice. I said above that the critics of rights talk often identify it as a modern innovation, that in earlier ages and societies, political discourse was not, as it often is with us, about rights. In the ancient world, for example, there was much more talk about things like community and virtue and duty, and very little, if any, talk about rights. So too with the medieval world, the world of St. Thomas Aquinas. Many influential historians of political and legal thought have argued that there is no doctrine of natural rights in the thought of Aquinas. Rather, Aquinas taught the doctrine of natural law. Rights are understood by modern political thinkers to be a kind of individual sovereignty, a protected zone in which the individual is free to make whatever choices she wants about some matter, a constituent element of necessarily individual freedom, and a kind of possession of individuals, almost like property. Law, however, restrains one's choices, and so limits the sovereignty of the individual. Natural law is one thing, an ancient or medieval thing. Natural rights are something entirely different, a modern thing. Rights are about freedom, laws are about restraint. And Aquinas on this view was very much on the restraint side. Natural rights emerge with those Enlightenment thinkers who rejected Thomistic moral and political thought. Among those Enlightenment thinkers was, most importantly for us Americans, John Locke. Several passages in the Declaration of Independence, written by Thomas Jefferson, are virtual quotations from Locke's Second Treatise on Government, which was published in 1690. If you ever visit Jefferson's stately home, Monticello, outside of Charlottesville in Virginia, you can see John Locke's portrait hanging in Jefferson's living room, with portraits of Francis Bacon and Isaac Newton, the three of whom Jefferson called my trinity of the three greatest men the world has ever produced. These two problems, I think, are closely related to one another. First, the change from the Declaration of Independence to Casey, and then second, this concern about whether or not rights are simply modern. They are closely related because the second claims to explain the first. if postmodernism is a reaction to modernism, then the Casey decision's seemingly insouciant postmodern view of rights is a natural development out of Jefferson's modern view, his modern view of rights in the Declaration, grounded as it was in the Enlightenment's rejection of Thomistic natural law. We have a very neat, if depressing, narrative here. Natural law is replaced by natural rights, which in turn yields to individualistic relativism. Now, the narrative may be true as far as it goes, although it's certainly too simplistic. But I want to leave this issue aside in favor of what seems to me to be the more important question moving forward. Did it have to work out that way? Does the recognition of natural rights necessarily lead to individualism and perhaps relativism? And must it be at odds with the natural law as Aquinas understood it? Must we choose between natural law and natural rights? To begin to answer this question, we need to gain some clarity about just what we mean by a right and what explains the existence of rights. So this is my second section. I want to talk about these two issues in turn, but first it's necessary to make an explicit a distinction that I've been assuming. I've been speaking mainly about natural rights, but those aren't the only kinds of rights. By natural right, we usually mean a right to which one is entitled simply in virtue of being a human person. For Aquinas, of course, all humans are persons, but not all persons are human. God is a person, in fact, three persons. Angels are persons. But there are also civil or legal rights to which persons are entitled in virtue of some specific status established by practice or by law. As we all know from watching Law and Order, or Homicide, I guess, actually, you might be too young for that, but that took place in Baltimore. You have a right to remain silent, and you have a right to an attorney if you're arrested. But those are not natural rights. The right to an attorney, if you're arrested, was established by the Supreme Court in a famous case called Miranda versus Arizona, 1966. Now, both natural and legal rights have certain features in common, which is important in what I say about the character of rights, but they are different. And it is the differences that matter most in discussing why there are rights at all. But first things first, what is a right? The most helpful analytical account of rights was produced by, actually, an American law professor in the early 20th century, a man named Wesley Newcomb Hofeld, who published a very influential article, in fact, one of the most influential law review articles ever published in the United States, in the Yale Law Journal in 1913. The real genius of Hofeld's analysis was his recognition that we often use the term right to mean quite different kinds of relationships between persons. I mean, that's the crucial thing, is that a right indicates a relationship. But we often use the word right to mean different sorts of relationships. This alone is significant, since it leads him to reject the notion commonly accepted that one could have a right to something, say a wristwatch, that was a relationship between you and that thing. My ownership of my watch is, on that sort of common view, a relationship between me and the watch. But Hofeld argued that there can be no such legal relationship between me and the watch. There can be no such legal relationship between a person and a thing. Legal relationships are only between persons. Now, they might be between persons relative to something, but they're not relationships with that thing. So my legal ownership of my watch is actually a relationship between me and everyone else, including all of you, relative to my watch. And if you try to steal it, the police will come, or maybe they will come. So rights are first, on this view, a kind of a relationship between persons. They are, in fact, what Hofeld argued are a three-term relationship between one person, one or more other persons, and some thing or act description of some kind. So generally speaking, there are three terms to any claim about rights on that. Now second, he distinguishes four meanings sometimes ascribed to the term right. The first type he calls a claim right. And this is a right in the strongest sense, because a claim right indicates the existence of a specific correlative duty. The most common case of claim rights in law involves things like contracts. If you agree to sell me your house, then we have a certain relationship. Once I've paid the money or secured a bank loan, I have a claim right to the house, and you have an obligation to provide the house, or at least the keys. Similarly, you have a claim right to payment, and I have an obligation to pay. One popular way of defining a right is to argue that rights exist where there is an obligation of some kind. And this is true of claim rights, but not necessarily true of other sorts of things that we refer to as rights. The second sort of right Hofeld distinguished was what he called a liberty right. Actually, he called it a privilege, but that complicates things, so just call it a liberty. A liberty right of some kind involves the absence of any operative claim rights. I have a liberty right to knock out the wall between my kitchen and my dining room if I want to. But I had no similar right when I lived in an apartment, since the apartment complex's owner forbade such things in the lease that I signed. They had a claim right against my doing certain things to the apartment. This is an important category, since we're often said to have rights that are often really liberties and entail no obligation on anyone else's part. I may want to knock down the wall, and I have a liberty to do so, but I lack the means or the money to pay a contractor. A third kind of right is a power. Power here means the power to perform some act with legal effect, especially the sort of effect that may alter the legal position of another person. I have a power if I'm under no legal liability from another party. I have the power to make a will, for example, which could alter the legal position of my natural heirs. I decide not to leave my money to my kids, but to somebody else. Spouses have powers over one another's legal positions. Similarly, adults have the power to enter into binding contracts of various kinds with one another. Finally, the fourth kind of relationship Hofeld discusses is called an immunity, meaning that one's legal position cannot be altered by the power of another. I have, for example, an immunity from being required to testify against my wife in a criminal proceeding against her. Some of the rights that make up the Bill of Rights appended to the United States Constitution, then, are really immunities. We can recognize this from the very language of some of the articles in the Bill of Rights. Congress shall make no law. That, in fact, creates a kind of immunity relative to what they're not allowed to make a law about, for example, the establishment of religion. The most important aspect of Hofeld's analysis is that it presses one to state propositions about rights with great precision, a precision that is often missing from the sorts of claims that so annoyed George Will and chagrined Ambassador Glendon. Hofeld was concerned, of course, with legal rights, not with natural rights. But his analysis applies to natural rights as well. To claim that some natural right exists, one must, I think, be able to specify who holds the right against whom, over what matters, and whether the right in question is a claim right, a liberty, a power, or an immunity. Now, I'll come back to this. But first, I want to say something about the more general ground of rights. Contemporary political and legal philosophers have tended to explain the existence of rights according to one of two theories. The benefit or interest theory of rights holds that rights are to be explained by reference to some benefit owed to one person by another, or a person's interest that must be legally protected. This theory was most famously defended by Jeremy Bentham, the founder of utilitarianism in the 18th century, and has been championed most strongly by later utilitarians. The other theory is usually called the choice or will theory of rights, and it's close to the view of rights I discussed earlier as a kind of individual sovereignty. The choice theorist holds that rights are really powers of individuals to make certain choices for themselves, free from interference from others, and that within their protected sphere, they are indeed a kind of individual sovereign. Everybody's like a sort of little king realm. The choice theorist rejects the benefit theory because they think it really isn't a theory of rights at all, since rights aren't doing any real work in the benefit theory, so they claim it. But the rights on that theory are more reflexes of the benefit or interest, which is really primary. So they say it isn't really a theory of rights at all. The most well-known recent choice theorist was a professor of jurisprudence at Oxford named H.L.A. Hart, who died in 1992. Hart was probably the most famous English-speaking philosopher of all of the last 50, 60 years. Now, interestingly, Hart partly changed his view of rights, which was the choice theory, on the basis of a criticism that was made of the choice theory by another contemporary legal philosopher, in this case a Scottish legal philosopher named Neil McCormick. McCormick favored the benefit theory and suggested a counterexample to the choice theory of rights that Hart could not explain, namely, the rights of children. Children below the age of majority have no legal powers in their own names, and therefore no, as it were, legal choices that they can make. And yet most people do seem to think that children have some legal rights. Now, if this is so, then the rights of children simply cannot be explained by the choice theory of rights. But they can be explained, McCormick held, by the benefit theory. Now, Hart was forced to concede the point, and so he abandoned his view that moral rights, including what were considered constitutional rights in most countries, could be explained by the choice theory, although he maintained that most explicitly legal rights could be explained in that way. In the case of moral rights, Hart suggested that the basis could only be located in certain very basic human needs. Now, both Hart and McCormick's view of rights are modern liberal views, and they're grounded, both of them, even though they're different, they have it in common that they're grounded in a kind of individualism. Moreover, McCormick's view, which is in many respects preferable, I think, is also tied to a kind of utilitarianism, which is problematic for reasons I won't enter into here. My aim in mentioning them is to show that the question of why there are any rights remains a disputed question. I now want to sketch out the sort of alternative understanding of rights that can be developed out of Thomistic moral principles. So this is my third section. In thinking about a Thomistic account of natural rights, we have to face up to the problem I mentioned earlier. There is no full-dress theory of natural rights in Aquinas. If you read the whole Summa, all three parts, 500 or so questions, not a single one of those questions on the subjects, de jure naturale, it's not there. There's no question or even article that spells this out. Now, this has led many to say that this is because it is a modern notion associated with thinkers like John Locke. Aquinas, this objection holds, has natural law. Locke has natural rights. Rights are individual powers. Laws are constraints. Now, one obvious way around this is to say that natural rights are derived in some way from natural law. So, for example, Aquinas clearly thinks that we have a duty to worship God. And this duty, therefore, entails the existence of a right to worship God, since, as we all know, ought implies can. I think this is true, but I don't think it gets us very far. It explains a few rights, but it does explain very many. Moreover, those who contrast rights and law reject the idea that the former can be derived from the latter, partly because they see rights as mainly a kind of power, the individual sovereignty that I mentioned, and that could not be rooted in a duty because it is the opposite of a duty. One reason for the impasse here, I think, is an erroneously narrow understanding of what Aquinas meant by natural law. Now, natural law is one of four kinds of law that Aquinas famously distinguishes in his so-called treatise on law, specifically in the Summa Theologiae, in the first part of the second part, question 91. Law as such is famously defined in question 90, the immediately previous question, famous formulation that he has there. He says, law is, quote, an ordinance of reason directed to the common good and promulgated by whoever has the care of the community, famous four-part definition. Laws, ordinance of reason, directed to the common good, promulgated by whoever has the care of the community, four parts, probably because he's thinking about Aristotle's four forms of causality from the second book of physics. Now, it's important that the ordinance, ordinatio, that he talks about in the first element of the definition, can mean a good bit more than simply an order or a command. It can and often does mean a kind of order. It is also important that punishment is not a part of Aquinas' definition of law. He later refers to it as an act of law, one of the things that laws do, but it is not a part of his essential definition. And in both of these things, that laws are not commands, simply, and that punishment is not an essential part of the definition of law, in both of these things, Aquinas' account of law is very different from many modern positivist definitions of laws that tend to assimilate laws to commands made on pain of sanctions of some kind. In question 91, Thomas tells us that there are four types of law. First, there is eternal law, which refers to God's providential government of the whole universe. It may seem strange to call that law, but it has all the characteristics assigned to law in the definition in question 90. It's rational, since God himself is the measure of reason. It's directed to the common good, in this case, the common good of the whole universe. And it issues from the one who has the care of the whole community of creation, God. Now, the third aspect, however, promulgation, may seem to be a bit sticky here. The eternal law resides first in God's mind, and we have no access to it, no direct access to it, so how can it be promulgated? Aquinas holds that it's promulgated in three somewhat unusual ways. He mentions promulgation in the Word and in the Book of Life. Promulgation in the Word, I take it, refers to the second person of the Trinity, Christ. Now, since God is three persons, there's a sense in which God promulgates the eternal law to himself. The Book of Life is a reference to the biblical book of Revelation, which refers to a book in which are written the names of those who are saved, indicating thereby also those who are damned. So this is a reference to God's foreknowledge of all of human history. Most importantly for our purposes, however, is a third sense in which the eternal law is promulgated. Thomas calls the second kind of law natural law, and he defines it as the rational creature's participation in the eternal law. Mankind participates in God's providential government of things through his own created nature, which is distinguished especially by the power of free, deliberate choice. Man is the cause of his own acts. And it is precisely in this sense that man is an image of God. We share in God's providential government through our free will, which is directed by reason. So the eternal law is promulgated to us through the nature that God gave us in creation. The natural law, then, is also law, in that it's an ordinance of reason, directed to the common good, and promulgated by whom has the care of the community. And it is therefore law because it shares these four characteristics of law. And it's also natural because it is promulgated to us through our created human nature, our rational nature. So the reason it's natural law, it's law because it shares all four of those elements in the definition of law, is natural law because we know it through the nature that God has given us through creation. We humans are the causes of our own actions and through our power of deliberate choice. Now Aquinas, like Aristotle, held that every action is for the sake of some good. So these acts that we choose are chosen in pursuit of goods. And those goods are goods. We choose them, we pursue them, because of the natures we have. Aquinas says in that same treatise on law, question 94, article 2, that we act for the sake of life. We act for the sake of offspring. We act for the sake of knowledge. And we act for the sake of social life itself. These are natural goods for human beings. And the natural law contains precepts that are related to the pursuit of these goods. The natural law, then, is Aquinas' way of referring to the intelligibility of human action. It is a participation in the eternal law because the eternal law controls all movements in the universe. The natural law is concerned with the human part of this. It describes our movements through our free, deliberate choices towards our goods. We pursue those goods, human beings pursue those natural goods through their natural abilities and powers, like thinking, locomotion, other powers that we have. Now, these powers work best when they're rightly disposed towards their objects. And the right disposition of those powers is what Aquinas calls virtues. In that same question 94, he says that the natural law includes the acts in accordance with all of the virtues. So virtue, too, is part of the natural law. We can see now that there's a rather simple synonym for the natural law: morality. It means that the morality that we can understand on the basis of natural reason. Now, I've gone into some detail about Thomas's understanding of the natural law because part of the challenge of thinking about natural rights from a Thomistic perspective is the opposition so commonly drawn between natural law on the one hand and natural rights on the other. But if by natural law Thomas means morality, the deliberate pursuit by human beings of their good through rational action, then I do not see how there must be any such opposition. The view I described before holds that natural law is all about constraints and natural rights all about freedom. This is surely wrong. The natural law for Aquinas is just as much about freedom as our natural rights. And if this is the case, then there is no inconsistency between the two and no bar to seeing the latter as somehow derived from the former. Natural rights derived from natural law. If natural rights are moral rights, part of morality, then they must be part of natural law. What else could they be? We're most accustomed to thinking about morality in terms of rules, and there are moral rules. Aquinas holds that the Ten Commandments are themselves precepts of the natural law. But virtues are also part of morality, and so also part of the natural law. So too are rights, at least natural rights. Now, if what I've argued just now is correct, the natural rights are derived from the natural law, and thus ultimately from the eternal law. But I've not said anything about how natural rights can be so derived. I think that from a Thomistic perspective, one can see natural rights is derived from principles of natural law in at least two ways. One way is fairly straightforward. Life is one of the natural goods distinguished by Aquinas in question 94, article 2. And he says there's a natural law precept that commands us to respect human life. Now later, in the second part of the second part of the Summa, where Aquinas discusses a lot of moral questions under the headings of the various virtues, Thomas holds that the intentional killing of human beings is permissible in only two cases: the killing of criminals by public authorities and the killing of enemy soldiers in a just war. The intentional killing of innocent persons, Aquinas holds, is always illicit and always forbidden. If Smith is an innocent person, then Jones has a duty to respect Smith's life, certainly not to kill him. Now remember Hofeld. The existence of a duty implies the existence of a correlate right. If Jones has a duty to respect Smith's life, along with everyone else's, since the duty is generalized, then Smith has a right to his life. Commands can, in this way, entail rights. Aquinas also holds that reproduction and the care of offspring are natural goods for human beings, and that there are natural law precepts that follow from this. One such precept, I think, is the following. Parents have a duty to educate their children. Children, therefore, have a correlate right to an education, a kind of claim right relative to their parents. So there are two natural rights. Now, those who reject the derivation of natural rights from natural law won't much like this. Their response would likely be that in the examples I just gave, the real work is not being done by the rights, but by the duties. The rights are merely reflexes of prior obligations, just the criticism that the advocates of the choice theory of rights make against the benefit theorists of other rights. The force of the criticism rests on the sense that here, the right is really just parasitic on the duty, no moral force of its own, but really just a kind of consequence. I'm not sure this is right, at least in these two cases. I think that circumstances may well make one take notice of the right first and the duty only later. I can well imagine, for example, seeing a neglected child and feeling that here is a human being deprived of what is her right, which she herself may not know at all. And only later, as a consequence, feeling a kind of indignation at the failure of her parents to do their duty. Or we may see that same child knowing that the parents have died or something like this, and then think this child continues to enjoy a right to an education. It can't be a duty of the parents since there are no parents, so it has to be made up somehow. The community somehow has to supply what's missing. But in both cases, we're thinking in terms of the right actually before we're thinking in terms of duty. There is, however, another aspect of this and another worry from those who think rights cannot be deprived from law, a little more technical. The term that we translate as right in Aquinas' Latin is the word jus, usually spelled I-U-S, sometimes J-U-S. It is the root of the word justice, justitia. Now, justice for Aquinas is, first of all, the name of a virtue, and only secondarily the name of a state of affairs. I think modern people, when they think about justice, they tend to think of who has what, or what the distribution of things is. But for Aquinas, following Aristotle, when they hear the word justice, the first thing that occurs to them is that it's a virtue of individuals. The virtue was defined by Aquinas in the Secunda Secundae, the second part of the second part, question 59, article 1, as the perpetual and constant will to render to each his jus. Sometimes that's translated as due, sometimes it's translated as his own, sometimes as right, which is wrong. Jus is also related to the term justum, which means a just thing. The just thing is the justum. Now this last, according to Aquinas, means, what's justum, a relationship between persons. He calls it a kind of adjustment, adequatio, between them. And he defines jus into two types, at least initially, then a third, into jus, what he calls jus naturale, natural right, and what he calls jus positivum, positive right, meaning a right that's been agreed on by human beings. The first means literally natural right, although crucially here it means, again, a relationship that is a function of nature itself. And we know this because Thomas gives two answers, gives two examples about this. One concerns a kind of equivalent value of things, as in a trade. If I give you something, you've got to give me something in return that's worth the same amount as what I gave you. The second example he gives is about the relationship between parents and children. The relationship between parents and children is natural, in the sense here, in that the children literally came from the bodies of the parents, in a strictly natural process. And their relationship is always a function of this. They are their parents, and their parents are theirs. Positive right, on the other hand, is the function of some kind of agreement, whether private or public. So the government has made, has conferred a right in some sense through law, or we've made a contract, in which case we both have rights relative to one another. Now, in between natural and positive right, for Aquinas, there's a third category, what Aquinas, following the ancient Roman lawyers, called jus gentium, literally the law of nations. This is a form of right, or relationship, whatever you want to call it, that isn't strictly natural, like that of parents and children, but it follows very quickly from reason, about the natural, main example that Aquinas gives of jus gentium concerns private property. That individual persons own things is not naturally right, because there is no natural relationship between any one person and any actual thing in the world, as distinct from the clear natural relationship between parents and children. Right? I mean, you can prove that I am the child of my parents, and they're my parents, and you can do it physically, it's a matter of biology, but there's absolutely no way to establish any kind of natural connection between me and my house keys. That individual person's own things is not naturally right, because there's no natural relationship between any one person and anything in the world, in contrast to the natural relationship of parents and children. Rather, property is the result of a social agreement or laws. Now, the facts of human nature suggest that private ownership is the best way to arrange property relations among persons under most circumstances. I mean, there may be exceptions. National emergencies or ship wreck or something. I mean, it may be better not to have private property. But mostly, in larger societies especially, it's the best way to do things. That's because of facts about human nature. So most human societies have this institution of property. But it's still a step removed from nature itself. This suggests that there are some claims of right that individuals could make on the basis of nature, natural rights in the strongest sense, like the right to life or to be cared for by one's parents. There are other rights that are rather close to being natural rights, but a step removed from them and classed as rights under jus gentium. For example, rights to the fruits of one's own labor. Finally, there are all kinds of rights, potentially, arrived at by public and private agreement that are thus parts of positive right or legal right. For example, the right to vote or to make contracts or wills or the right to an attorney if you've been arrested. Now, one more wrinkle here. Remember that jus is the object, Aquinas says, of justice, of the virtue of justice. Aquinas follows Aristotle in seeing different parts of the virtue of justice. He says, for example, that there's one kind of justice which he calls legal justice that directs one's actions to the common good. There is also particular justice which directs one's acts relative to other persons. Particular justice is itself divided between what he calls distributive justice, which concerns the distributions from goods that are common to the community, to individuals, and what he calls commutative justice, which directs one and one's relationships with other persons, for example, in buying and selling, or even compensating one another for losses or injuries, but also punishments meted out to criminals. The two types of particular justice are particular relative to legal justice. So even those two, distributive justice and commutative justice, are related to the common good. The idea of the common good is obviously important here. It's a big topic. And I just want to make two quick remarks about it. First, a common good is a good that is shareable. And the good that is most common, most shareable for Aquinas, is the final and universal good of the whole universe, which is God. But the political community itself is a kind of common good that is sometimes called the temporal or political common good. For Thomas, of course, the temporal common good is subject to the universal, ultimate common good. And so one's relationship in justice to that good transcends politics. For Aquinas, religio, which we translate as religion, but maybe not always the best word, but Thomas's Latin, religio, is the name also of a virtue related to justice. It's a part of justice, he says. A virtue that disposes one to give God what is God's jus, which is worship and honor. And this would be, for Aquinas, the basis of a natural right to religious freedom. Now, finally, very short ending section. In conclusion, I want to admit to you that the modern rights theorist will not be persuaded by what I have just said, for a reason that you may well have anticipated. If a right is a kind of individual sovereignty, a zone of freedom in which one's choices are entirely a function of one's will, then the Thomistic account of natural rights I have suggested is not an account of rights in this sense. It is, a modern theorist would say, an account of right in the singular. Not rights, but right. Which is not a protected zone of individual sovereignty, but a kind of objective relationship between persons, one in which duties and the common good play a major role. I suspect that nothing I have said about this otherwise will convince him. And there's a sense in which it shouldn't. In the end, there is a divide between the Thomistic account I've given, and which I think is the sober truth about the matter, and the modern understandings of rights. One that goes right back to Thomas Jefferson with his trinity of Bacon, Newton, and Locke. This was not the trinity of St. Thomas Aquinas. For Aquinas, natural rights and natural law are ways in which we are ordered to our final ends in the universal good that is God. For Jefferson and his successors, not least the judges who signed on to the majority opinion in the Casey decision, we are our own ends. Thus our own sovereigns, sovereign individuals who must get along with one another. There is ultimately, I think, no getting around this difference. But, and this is my final point, when we think of the most important human rights, what Aquinas would call natural rights, things like the right to life, the right to care and upbringing, the right not to be tortured, the right to worship freely, we think of ways in which those rights are protected by the institutions and practices of modern political and legal systems. Institutions are often related to theories, but they are not the same thing as theories. And the same institutions can be upheld and maintained on the basis of more than one type of theoretical account. I think that modern theories of rights, as the individual sovereignty of persons who are their own ends, is mistaken and often leads to just the problems with which I began. But unlike some of those who have noted these problems, I do not believe the remedy is to repudiate the notion of natural or human rights. The protections they afford human persons against the terrible power of modern states are too important. The remedy is to explain them and improve them on the basis of a better theory. St. Thomas Aquinas did not produce a theory of human rights, but his moral and political thought contained the materials out of which a better theory can be constructed. Thank you.
So we have time for questions.
So my understanding is correct. Mentioning is correct. You were trying to defend the derivation of natural rights from duties, correct?
Not from duties necessarily, but from natural law, which includes duties, but not only duties.
Well, I guess maybe my question is, what happens when those kind of duties conflict, between two different people, and it would then, seem as though two different rights are in conflict, two different rights to life. Upbringing, different rights to property.
So what kind of a conflict do you have in mind?
At one level, is it a kind of conflict that speaks to the impossibility of universal rights?
What I meant was, give me an example. What specific kind of conflict would lead to this?
I guess, the hot topic is always abortion. Right to the mother's life, right to the child's. Is that, I haven't given that.
So is there really a conflict?
Is there a possibility that there could be conflict between human rights? Or is there something about a right in itself that could?
Well, Yeah, I mean, when we ask whether there could be a conflict between two human rights or natural rights, I mean, I was using the term natural rights. Sometimes people say human rights, sometimes I say human rights. I mean, that I use them equivalently, but not everybody does. There's a reason people prefer to say human rights. Often it has to do with the fact they don't want to say natural rights, because they don't want to say there's some set of human rights that are permanent, that rights are kind of a historical development and might change and have changed and so forth. But when you say that, you've got to give a particular example, because in the abstract, it's not clear how you even go about settling it. Now, in the case of abortion, so there's one complication here, which is, I mean, Aquinas' views about abortion are slightly complicated in that he had a kind of defective Aristotelian biology, which led him to think that, and he was not alone in this, a lot of other people thought that, an embryo was not a human person until a certain period of time had passed. Now, he still thought it was wrong, even if it was not a human person at that stage. There was no question about that. But there is that little complication now. If Aquinas had access to the biological knowledge that we have, I assume he would see it the same way that we do. So the question there is, can there be a conflict between the two? Well, only in the case can there be the kind of conflict that you mentioned, where the pregnancy poses the danger of ending the life of the mother. Now, as far as I know, I don't think Aquinas ever discussed a case like this anywhere. But on the basis of Thomistic ethics, contemporary ethicists certainly talk about it. And the principle that they go to in that case is the one that I mentioned, that intentionally taking a human life is always wrong. Now, there's a famous text that comes from Aquinas' discussion of killing in the second part of the second part of the Summa. And there's a famous text in there, which you may have heard of, which is where Thomas is giving an example. It's one of the articles in the question on killing, and he says, what about killing in self-defense? So there's a case where maybe your life is in conflict with somebody else. He says, what about killing in the case of self-defense? He says, well, he says, in some cases, one action has more than one effect. It can have two, at least. It might even have more than two, but can have two effects. But only one of those effects is intended by the agent. Now, morally speaking, that's what's crucial to you as an agent, is what you intend. So if somebody attacks you, and you defend yourself against that attack, and in the course of your defending against the attacker, you kill the attacker, but you didn't intend to kill him. Your intention was simply to defend yourself against the assailant. Then Aquinas says, you're not guilty of anything. Now, if when the person attacks you, you would say to yourself, you form the intention immediately, aha, I'm going to kill him, and then you kill him, well, then you have, in fact, taken a human life. And Aquinas says that's only listed in these two cases, and it's always got to be authorized by the public authorities. An individual private person can't intend to kill another person, ever, he says. That's sometimes called the principle of double effect. And that's usually the principle that comes into play when people in medical ethics are talking about a case like the one you mentioned. So if you've got, you know, a pregnancy that causes a risk of death to the mother, a medical intervention that's intended to save the life of the mother is licit, even if it has the effect of ending the life of the child. But if the medical intervention intends to end the life of the child, that's another story. That would be violating the principle against intentionally taking a human life. So that's how I assume Thomas would answer that question. Now, there may be other conflicts that you have, but that one would be.
So in going off Carl's question, you said that it'd be difficult to answer this question in the abstract. But I was wondering, you know, when you talk about natural rights as derived from natural law, there's a duty there to the common good, right? Wouldn't that common good be objectively the same because it's derived from an objective truth, God, right? So in that sense, might you be able to approach it from that way and say that, well, there's no two ways about it. The common good is always the same, so the duty towards the common good is always the same, and therefore everyone has rights that are oriented in a particular way.
That's true. That's certainly true. And that could go some distance in settling a lot of these problems, but there are problems that are occasionally difficult, like the one you mentioned. I mean, look, even in a case where you say, okay, I've got the principles, I know what's going on, it's still a heart-wrenching situation, right? I mean, it could end badly. I mean, or consider another situation that may be analogous to that, right? I mean, Aquinas actually says, at one point, there's a question in the second part, about stealing, which is wrong, he says. It's wrong in and of itself. It's objectively a wrong act. He says, what about stealing in the case of necessity? By which he means, for example, if a person is starving, could they steal food from someone else? And he says, yes, they could. But it's not stealing. In the case of necessity, they actually have a right to what they need to survive. And for them to take it is not stealing. And part of the reason it's not stealing is that business I mentioned about jus gentium being one step removed from what's naturally right in and of itself, right? Again, because there's no natural relationship between you and any piece of property, that relationship is mediated by social convention in some sense. And why is that? Well, because when the world was made, human beings didn't own anything. And according to Aquinas, the world and all the things in it are for the benefit of the human beings. Now, it's best, you've got to arrange it some way, and private property is the best way to arrange it. But the basic principle here is that things are for people. There are people and there are things. And things are for the sake of people. And so in a case of necessity, where a person is starving and they don't have what they need to survive, the property relationships, as it were, fall away, and you revert to the basic principle that things are for people, and they therefore have a right to what they need because of the natural right that you have to preserve your own life. Does that make sense?
So are you going to kind of hierarchy of rights, and like right to life will always come to right to property?
Well, certainly natural rights are at the very top. And again, a right to property is not exactly a natural right. It's close. It's close. But he puts it under jus gentium, which is sort of between natural and positive rights.
It might be like a slippery slope, kind of like a socialist kind of organization of goods, in which you say, maybe a certain group of individuals aren't necessarily starving every day, but they have a right to a certain well-being or a certain standard of life that would be possible if others gave up a portion of their property rights.
Well, Aquinas actually talks about that too, at least in a kind of somewhat removed sense, under the heading of actually almsgiving. And now, again, people have a right to what they need in that radical sense, but for the most part, Aquinas thinks, I mean, this is what he says at any rate, that people should be free in giving things to other people that they need, as distinct from being compelled to do it. Now, in case of necessity, you can just take it. But if it's not simply immediate necessity, I think his idea is that it's better that be done voluntarily by people. Now, you could imagine an emergency situation in which maybe the government would have to do it, but the ordinary situation, I think, that he thinks is preferable is that people do it voluntarily. So socialism, I would say there's no... I don't know how you would give an argument for socialism as we understand it in Aquinas, but I also don't know how to give an argument necessarily for capitalism as we understand it, because the 13th century is economically somewhat different from our own time. So it doesn't translate, immediately. I mean, the translation would be a little more involved. But certainly private property, he's for.
I thought I saw the contradiction with the natural right. Stealing out of need, and like if you have need, that just somehow justifies the act of stealing, when natural law, which is the Ten Commandments, says thou shalt not steal. So, is that justifying it because he's stealing out of need?
Aquinas says he's not stealing.
Law says, thou shalt not steal. And But stealing out of need is now somehow inherently right because it's out of need. So.
Well, it's only stealing if you take what belongs to another. In a case of necessity, Aquinas holds, you have a right to the object of that necessity. Now, he's really talking about necessity here. This doesn't work for flat-screen TVs or... I mean, I think basically it works for food and water. maybe not much else, you know. But in that case, he says, since you've reverted to this kind of primitive natural principle that things are for people, the conventional distributions of property sort of go by the wayside. He has this principle he quotes there, in necessitate omnia communia sunt. In cases of necessity, everything is common. And that's why he says it's not stealing. It's not actually stealing. So it doesn't violate the Ten Commandments.
According to
him. Yes.
Misperception, misinterpretation of
Well, he's got an argument. I mean, you could disagree with it,
right.
Sure.
Okay.
That's the argument.
One of Carl's first questions was, could two rights, two different people's rights conflict? So what about the case of, like, a terminally ill child and parents who won't seek the medical intervention that the child needs but wants? So the parents have a right to care for their child as they see fit according to their conscience, but the child could conceivably receive care and, say, in this scenario, wants to.
Yeah, I mean, I see no reason why Aquinas wouldn't say that some kind of intervention by the community on behalf of the child is justified there in the same way that an intervention is justified if, for example, somebody wants to assault you and you call the police and they stop it. Because the kind of neglect that you're talking about is really sort of starts to shade into criminal assault, really, in a way. I mean, you're damaging the other person's life and so forth. So at that point, there are legal remedies that would presumably be available.
But so that the natural rights conflict or don't conflict?
Well, there are both natural rights and natural duties. And the right, remember, is a kind of relationship, in this case, between the parents and the child. And so there are certain obligations that the parents have if they fail to perform them.
In whose opinion did they fail to perform them, though?
Well,
so
again, this is, so at the level of kind of moral principle, it's very general. And the way societies make it more specific is to then legislate.
Right, right.
And so again, the same way if you think that I'm threatening you, you could call the police and we'd sort that out. This is like that too. I mean,
so does the parent's right to care for their child trump their right to do it the way they see fit?
I think so. I mean, just in the case that, let's say you have a right to live, a strong right to preserve your own life. And let's say you've had a kidney failure, and the only way that you're going to survive is a kidney transplant of some kind. And you sign up for the waiting list, and you're number 5,068, and you think you're never going to live long enough to get a new kidney. But there's always China, and right? I mean, or you make your own private China, right? In other words, you kidnap somebody and, right? I mean, say you're a doctor.
I grow it in the lab, but okay.
You actually know how to do it. Yeah. Well, once we're there, we don't have to follow. But you carve out the kidney, you get a treatment, whatever. I mean, again, you have a right to life, for sure. You have a right to preserve your life. But you can't do that by doing something that's objectively wrong to another person. And the same is true, I think, with respect to the parents and the children. I think that's right.
Any other thoughts? So we can officially. Oh, do you want to? Yeah, go ahead. I was gonna say we can end the Q&A and mingle and ask questions, but go for it.
So this is still kind of abstract, so kind of borrowing from like commands on behalf of Jesus to you know die to oneself and to cover oneself or to the other and to will the other. Is there a sense in which that kind of duty could play into these some difficult questions where, like, you know, if there's competing, you know, I'm going to live or someone else is going to live, you know, and it's kind of like a binary thing. Do we have a duty as Christians to will the good and the life of the other and to save our own, and therefore suspending our own rights of life?
Well, greater love hath no man than he lays down his life for his friends, right? And so that's, but there's the old distinction in Catholic moral theology, I'm not a theologian, so I speak at my own peril, but between commands and counsels, so law is one thing, supererogatory virtue, which is to say virtue that goes beyond what a person is required to do, is something else. I don't see how you can simply require a person in a situation where there's a totally precise symmetry, it's you or him. The case the Stoics always talked about was a shipwreck, and there's one plank in it, but it'll sink if there's two people, only one. What do you do? And, generally speaking, they threw up their hands and said, "Whatever." You know, I mean, this is lifeboat ethics, right? And the thing about lifeboat ethics is that there's no answer. Now, in the face of lifeboat ethics, we have two choices. One is to say, aha, there's no answer. There's no morality because there's this lifeboat thing. The other one is to just say, yeah, that's a damn hard case. Search me. But in fact, the vast majority of cases are really easy. And the fact that there's 1/100th of 1% of the cases that are so hard I can't figure them out doesn't in fact follow from that there are no moral rules.